Hello, a very, very warm welcome to you. As you know, for those of you who have been following us from the beginning of the series, this series has covered all 18 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. And in this particular episode, as with the previous one, we are looking at a subject called themes, that which is taken from chapter to chapter within the Bhagavad Gita, the commonalities, and what do they mean. Sister Denise has been sharing her wisdom and spiritual experience with us, and she will take us through her understanding of the themes contained in the Bhagavad Gita. Sister Denise, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
The first theme that I'd like to take up is violence versus non-violence. And the reason this is of interest to me is when we meet Arjuna and Sri Krishna at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, they're on a battlefield. They're at war. And Arjuna is reluctantly at war with family members. More than once in the book, we hear about God saying to him about the importance of non-violence. This is at odds with each other, and it left many a Hindu person confused as a result.
That's right, because on the one hand, Krishna is asking Arjuna to kill, and all the way through he continues to do that, and at the same time he talks about the virtue of non-violence. So it's really a kind of exercise in Arjuna's willingness to destroy his attachments. And so I think the killing is not really about using weapons, but really about cutting and breaking the attachments which lead to the delusion, which arise from the other delusion that I am a body, or that these people are bodies. And non-violence corresponds to the essential qualities of the soul, which is purity, peace, love, bliss, inner power. Because of the way that it is visually represented by artists through the ages, it appears to be a total paradox, and people have to side with one side or the other. And this is why I think we have to really go into the deeper spiritual meaning and the symbolic meaning of the Gita, and then apply it to ourselves. Because each and every one of us has to deal with our attachments very proactively. We have to use firmness, determination, strength, and at the same time we have to be not trying to force ourselves. This would not be Raj Yoga, this would be Hatha Yoga, yoga by force. So it's very deep and actually requires a lot of meditation. It's another one of these paradoxes.
Sister Denise, what you just said makes a lot of sense, because it does not stand to reason that God will teach someone how to be violent.
Well, no, it doesn't fit. It doesn't
no,
suit.
No, it doesn't fit. Yet God is telling Arjuna that he needs to take up arms, but the fight is, as you just said, internal.
I think there's another element too, because, you know, a king has to be able to defend his country. Arjuna is the number one archer in the world. But the whole thing is that you have to be dispassionate. And violence is really when anger takes you over. And I think that even if a person is engaging in the art of war, in any military functioning, you know, there are rules of war which have to be done very accurately, and it cannot be on the basis of an emotion to cause a person suffering out of being in a state of passion is the thing that's wrong.
To be dispassionate. I think that is a word that viewers should consider, to be dispassionate. How dispassionate am I? Sister Denise, the next two words that I've picked up is, and help me with my pronunciation here, please, karma bandhan versus karma sambandh.
Yeah, the karmic bondages which hold people together and cause there to be mutually intensifying suffering. This is why a lot of the sages and gurus have said that karma in and of itself is something to be avoided. And so there is also the strand in the Bhagavad Gita which is talking about karma sannyas, that means the renunciation of action. And you remember there was a whole conversation about the difference between renouncing action and renouncing desire for the fruit of action. Now, karma samband is something we talk about a lot in the practice of Raj Yoga within the context of Brahma Kumaris. And we believe that all of us come into our spiritual practice with a lot of karmic debts, karmic accounts, karmic bondages with people who come into our contact, but because of some interaction in some previous birth, there is unresolved karma which takes the form of some difficulty or another in relationships. Through meditation and through spiritual practice and the development of spiritual powers and virtues, you can transform that situation which has a tendency to compel you to intensify the karmic bondage, where you loosen it and transform the relationship so that it is a relationship of harmony. Karma samband is a relationship of harmony where it had been a relationship of difficulty, suffering, problems. And this is also connected with the idea of yoga enabling a person to live a life of freedom within life, jivan mukti.
Sister Denise, many people watching you right now are not aware that a relationship can be healed by performing pure karma, because we use other mechanisms to heal relationships, or if a relationship is really bad, we walk away from it. To heal a karmically indebted relationship is, I think, news to many.
It's wonderful, because the people that you are in connection with are wonderful people, but because of problems of interaction, you're unable to enjoy those beautiful relationships. But now with this information, you can.
The next aspect, Sister Denise, that we hear of from chapter 2 right up until chapter 18 is the three gunas. And I think this is one of the signatures, if you will, of the Bhagavad Gita, and that which is one of the deepest messages. Would you like to share something on that?
Yes, it's very deep. Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. So the pure state, the middle state, or the passionate state, and the impure state. And there were many, many chapters in which it talked about the intellect, the pure intellect, passionate intellect, the impure intellect or dull intellect, pure intentions, middle, dull, impure. In this translation, they're called material nature. But in our interpretation in Brahma Kumaris, we talk of them as the state of purity. In some ways, it corresponds to the idea of entropy, where everything just kind of loses its coherence and its consistency, its energy. So a person who is really pure, and when you're looking at the reincarnations, you're going through from the Satyuga, Treta Yuga, Dwapur Yuga, Kali Yuga. So in the Satyuga, you would be completely pure, and the whole world would be completely pure and everything in it. And there's this gradual devolution as you go through time, where things have a tendency to lose their integrity, to fall apart, to grow old, to lose their capacity, their juice. So that by the time we reach the Kali Yuga, we're very impure, we can't think so well, we can't make good decisions, we make a lot of mistakes in our interactions with each other. We don't understand who we are or who anyone else is. It's an interesting concept that doesn't actually exist in the Western world. And I think also in India, there are these two contradicting streams. On the one hand, there is this belief in progress, which is all part of Western civilization. And on the other hand, there is this understanding that things start off the best and they gradually lose their essence. And I think this is also why in India there is a lot of importance given to wisdom that has been passed on through the ages, and a lot of respect is given to that. Nevertheless, even that deteriorates. People's ability to comprehend it deteriorates. And this is why there is this idea that the knowledge of the Gita is given once again to reset everything up in its pure or satopradhan condition. And then you see God is outside the machine. You know, we have this expression, Deus ex machina. So the machine of the cycling of reincarnation and the souls coming into it and declining in quality, that's all the machinery. Sometimes also we hear the machinery of the laws of karma, because it's inexorable. You can't escape from it and you can't get away. The only one who is outside of that machine is incorporeal God, who then gives the knowledge of it, which is called the knowledge of the creator and the creation. And then we have to understand that and become satopradhan once again. So it's very, very deep and interesting concept.
This is one of my personal favorites because of the way it's presented in the scripture, understanding versus becoming. The reason it's of interest to me, Sister Denise, is because it's so easy to think, I've been so good today, I've read the Bhagavad Gita.
That's right, and becoming is very subjective, very personal, and sometimes it's quite difficult to assess. When it's to do with understanding, your intellect is involved, and the intellect can process ideas. It doesn't have anything to do with goodness and badness and am I being true, am I being false. It's sort of mathematical. But when it comes to becoming, there is where, you know, am I real? Am I true to myself? Am I having still any hypocrisy? Am I double standards? Do I understand really what this means? Am I living it? They're much more subtle questions that are difficult for a person to answer. But the understanding is always a means to an end. And the end is, what am I, what have I become? And in a way, we have to see what has happened to us in terms of our decline, and then what we have to do and how well we're doing in terms of our personal evolution. Because I do feel that this period of time where we study the Gita knowledge, or where God gives the Gita knowledge once again, that is really the time of evolution. We do evolve, we must evolve, and that also creates another paradox, because physically we may be growing older and getting tamopradhan in that sense. Spiritually we have to become pure, we have to come back to our origins, and so we're kind of going in physically in one direction and spiritually in the opposite direction.
The next one that I discovered is a friend to the self versus foe to the self. That one is big, as in seriously big.
Yeah, you are your own best friend, you are your own worst enemy. I mean, this has often been said, but when you see it in the Gita, it's a very ancient text, you see that people have been doing this to themselves, either being really good or really bad to the self for a long time. It's not something new. but it's definitely something that we need to understand deeply about so that we are truly doing what is right for ourselves, you know. If you are really connecting with God, that is the best thing that you can do for yourself. If you're coming under the influence of other people, you're giving your power away, that is not good for yourself.
Yeah, that one's very powerful, Denise, giving one's power away. I think that leads to my next one, which is awareness versus forgetting.
You know, that almost at the end of the 18th chapter, you have this very, very famous expression in the mouth of Arjuna, and God asks him, have you understood? Did you listen with a concentrated mind? Are you, you know, free from your attachments now? Have you understood? And he says, Nashto moha smriti labdha, I have destroyed my attachments and I am aware. You see, smriti is a very wonderful word. It is, in this translation, is described as wisdom. I have found my wisdom. But I like to use the word aware. I'm aware. I've got it. I've understood. When you're aware, you do everything right. And so I think a very important part of this Gita is to bring us to this state of awareness. But what happens is you forget. You know, it happens even when people are doing inner work, a psychological work. They will get insights, they will understand something, and they'll be able to hold it for just a matter of minutes, and then it disappears. It's a strange quality of human consciousness that you can get it, but then you lose it.
Sensorial experiences versus asensorial experiences.
This is a very interesting one because the mind is described in the Gita as a sixth sense. And with the mind detached from the physical senses, it is then able to perceive non-physical realities. You speak of happiness through the senses. We use the expression, you know, eye candy, ear candy, tongue candy, whatever. But something that delights the senses, yeah? And this is sensorial pleasure. But then, you know, when the mind is actually tasting the qualities of God and feeling what yourself is internally, this is asensorial. And you can only do that when you practice detachment from the sense organs, which is only possible when you practice detachment from the whole body. And for that, you have to really identify as a soul and really know that there is a whole dimension of experience that is beyond the material world.
Neutrality.
Yes, neutrality. So many people feel that neutrality, that's not life. You know, you don't want to be neutral about everything.
Yeah, there's that people of the view, Sister Denise, that is a very dull and boring life. And they feel, most people feel, if you're neutral, it's like not even having a pulse.
Yes. Well, in a way, it connects with the idea of being dispassionate. That's also neutral. What comes in the Gita very often is the idea of equilibrium, equanimity, because it is said that if you were caught up in these dualities of pain, pleasure, success, failure, etc., this prevents you from going to that other level. And we do also talk about neutral karma. In the Gita, we hear a lot about non-action. And in Brahma Kumari's Raja Yoga, we wouldn't use the expression non-action for akarma. We would use the word neutral action. The idea is this. When you come to your spiritual practice, you have a lot of debts. So you want to build up your pure karma to neutralize those debts. and you don't want to do any more negative karma to get into any more debt. So once you've brought your debts to zero, then you want to continue to do beneficial karma. So in a way, karma that you don't have to do because you don't have any more debts, it's sort of extra, it's a kind of non-action because you're not reacting against the energy that pulls you into negative action. So it's very neutral, but its result is very pure.
Sister Denise, I'd like to ask another question on the philosophy of karma, because it's something that you raised in another episode, which I thought was very profound. When a negative quality emerges, how does one deal with that? And you said it falls under the aspect of karma. Could you share a bit about that?
Our consciousness, our mind, is connected with our sense perceptions, our sense organs. So things that come into our mind come in from the external material world, but it's also connected with our subconscious, memories, past impressions, things like this. So there's a lot of stuff that's coming up from the inside. And when you're talking about the dark side, you know, where do your sins live? They live in your subconscious. So you don't really have direct access to them, but they kind of drive how you're feeling and how you're perceiving, how you're interpreting things that are going on around you. So this stuff will come up, especially when you do more yoga, more of it will come up. And this is why you have to be very aware about it and understand that when you do meditate, you will be bringing up all of these unresolved things. So this is why you have to have virtue cultivation and power cultivation. There are yogic powers, because you have to deal with that. In order to become free from impurities, free from negative karma, this is where they live. They live deep down inside. So unless they come up, you cannot deal with them. And so we would actually invoke them and say, okay, let it come up. Let me deal with my stuff and use the qualities, powers, the information, all of it to deal with it and take care of it and not take it personally and not entertain it. I think a very important thing is to be able to identify it, deal with it quickly, and move on.
Last one I have for you for today is ego versus truth, which is probably the main aspect.
Yes, ego. Well, false ego. Truth means to be true to yourself. Truth means to know who you are, to know what you are. Ego is characterized by being reactive and feeling insulted, because there are many things that happen or people that trigger this sense that, oh, how dare you talk to me like that, and then immediately you have a reaction which is passionate or dark or something like this, and then you know that you're operating out of ego. So there is a practice of humility. Sometimes for a yogi, you'll experience humiliation. And when you experience humiliation, we would say, well, this is an exam whose function is to enable me to achieve a state of humility. But that requires a lot of personal self-respect and inner power, you know, because it's quite hard to be really neutral about a humiliation. But it is known to be an exam, and you have to really be competent in handling the exam of humiliation so that it doesn't damage you, it doesn't move you, but you're able to just be very dispassionate, detached, understand very clearly that, okay, here is something that is designed to humiliate me, but it's not you're kind of non-combustible, and it doesn't catch you, doesn't catch fire like that.
Sister Denise, thank you so much. I hope you have found this particular episode to be of some interest to you. The themes that are mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita have a direct impact on the quality of our lives if you should let it be so or do so. That is the operative word, that is the key word, if you allow it to be so. So I do hope that you understood what Sister Denise was sharing as far as this episode is concerned, as well as the others. And I hope you are able to look at yourself and ask yourself, what is, for example, my understanding of the three gunas? Do I really understand the law of karma? What are the quality of my relationships? I hope you use this episode, as well as the Bhagavad Gita itself, to assess where you are at in life. And I hope that you enjoyed this episode, and we hope to see you again for the next one. Do take care. And Sister Denise, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Goodbye to you.